This is Doug Ward at NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, where we're talking with Alan Shepard, Chief of the Astronaut Office.
Captain Shepard, what is the significance of the upcoming Apollo 4 mission, an unmanned flight from the astronaut's point of view?
The Apollo 4 mission is a planned flight in a sequence of flights in the Apollo program, which follows the same course of action that we successfully used in the Mercury and Gemini programs. One of the most important things about a spacecraft is to determine that it will be able to re-enter into the Earth's atmosphere after its space flight. We, in the Mercury program and in the Gemini program, utilized unmanned flights prior to the manned flights to test the efficiency of the heat shield at re-entry velocities into the atmosphere. The purpose of the Apollo 4 flight is like these flights that we successfully completed in Mercury and Gemini. That is, the heat shield of the Apollo spacecraft will be tested at the re-entry velocities expected when the vehicle comes back from the moon. Now, in order to do this, we will not make a complete circumlunar mission to achieve this velocity. We will make a flight which goes only out to, say, 9 or 10,000 miles away from the surface of the Earth, but one in which the spacecraft increases its velocity through a thrusting vector as it comes back down to a lower altitude, so that it will hit the Earth's atmosphere at close to the same velocities that we expect on the return from the moon. If this flight is successful, of course, it will be a large step forward in the Apollo program, a step that will show us that the heat shield is as efficient as is required and that it will provide for a safe return of a manned spacecraft into the Earth's atmosphere at these high lunar return velocities.
How closely does this Apollo 4 unmanned spacecraft resemble the craft that astronauts Schirra, Isley, and Cunningham will actually be flying?
Well, it's almost identical in the heat shield configuration, which of course is the most important objective of the test. Although Schirra, Isley, and Cunningham will be re-entering from Earth orbital velocities, which will of course be lower than those experienced by the Apollo 4, nonetheless it will be an important test for revalidation of our previous heat shield tests, but more importantly, for revalidation of the higher speed re-entry velocities.
Thank you very much, Captain Shepard.
This is Doug Ward at NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, where we've been talking with Chief Astronaut Alan Shepard.
Apollo 4 interview number 3 with Charles Filley.
This is Doug Ward at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, and we're talking with Charles Filley of MSC's Landing and Recovery Division. Mr. Filley, could you describe for us the recovery operations on this upcoming Apollo 4 mission?
First of all, we utilize both ships and aircraft for recovery support in the launch area. We'll have recovery helicopters which will operate off of land and provide any support in the launch site area in the event that we do get a landing in that area. We also have several small boats which can be used in the area. Further on downrange, about a distance of about 400 miles, we will be attempting the first stage booster retrieval, retrieval of any of the components that may survive impact and float after impact. Additionally, we'll be trying to retrieve 2 film cassettes, which will be ejected from the launch vehicle just after launch, about 10 minutes into the launch.
What is the purpose of these film cassettes or canisters?
Now, the film cassettes are to take pictures of the separation of the first stage from the second stage.
After the spacecraft goes into orbit, what will your recovery mode of operation be?
Our mode of operation will be one of just monitoring the mission, and in the event that some contingency does occur, then we can provide support both in the Atlantic and in the Pacific. Most of the alternate missions or any of the anticipated failures that could occur will still produce landings in the Pacific and near the planned end of mission point.
What is the planned landing point for Apollo 4?
The planned landing point is in the vicinity of 171 degrees west and 30 degrees north, about 850 miles northwest of Hawaii.
Will the prime recovery vessel be an aircraft carrier?
Yes, it will. We'll have the, as is currently planned, the USS Bennington will be the prime recovery ship, and on board there will be helicopters to provide search and recovery support in that area.
After splashdown, your normal procedure would be to come alongside the spacecraft with the aircraft carrier, if possible, and pick it up with a crane attached to the flight deck of the carrier and pull it up on the deck. Is this right?
All right. They have a crane on board the ship, and once the UDT personnel on board the helicopters have affixed the flotation collar, the carrier will pull up alongside of the spacecraft and retrieve it with its what's known as the B&A crane, the boat and aircraft crane. And it'll be brought onto the probably the number three elevator on the Bennington, and then we'll go through extensive post-retrieval deactivation procedures. We'll have some engineers on board who will take a look at the heat shield, which is one of our primary tests on this mission, and additionally we'll have some powering down of the spacecraft to do, equipment removal, pulling out some film, and getting it on back to Houston with some carrier onboard delivery flights.
Thank you very much, Mr. Philly. This is Doug Ward at NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center, where we've been talking with Mr. Charles Philly of MSC's Landing and Recovery Division.
Apollo 4, interview number 5 with General O'Connor.
This is Randy Neely at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. The countdown for the upcoming launch of the first Apollo Saturn V vehicle brings together the efforts of thousands of minds, men, and companies, a management responsibility that has no parallel in U.S. industry or government. The Industrial Operations segment of the Marshall Center has directed the management of the Saturn V developmental program from initial design through purchase of individual components, fabrication, and testing, to the approaching moment of liftoff. To understand or get an appreciation of the complexity of such a monumental undertaking, I'm talking to Brigadier General Edmund O'Connor, Director of Marshall's Industrial Operations. General O'Connor, about how many companies and people will have played a role in the launch of the first Saturn V?
Well, Randy, all the people who worked on the earlier programs, the Redstone, the Jupiter, the Saturn I, and the uprated Saturn I launch vehicle programs will have made a serious and vital contribution to the Saturn V. These were the forerunning programs to the Saturn V. At its peak, I suppose that there were hundreds of companies, universities, and literally thousands of individuals from every state in the United States who have played a role in the Saturn V program. Against a background of some 12,500 prime contractors, subcontractors, and vendors who at one time or another worked on the total Apollo Saturn program, I would hazard to guess that somewhere close to 150,000 people have made an individual contribution to the Saturn V.
Doesn't bringing together all the physical elements of the Saturn V at one central focal point pose a great many logistics problems?
You're certainly right. The very size of the Saturn V presents a problem in itself, some 365 feet high, plus the fact that the majority of our prime contractors are located throughout the United States, however, primarily on the West Coast. One important factor in our favor, however, is that the first stage, the largest stage on the Saturn V, is manufactured and tested in NASA facilities, which really are as close to the launch site as possible. These facilities I'm referring to are our Michoud Assembly Facility and the Mississippi Test Facility. At Michoud, the design, fabrication, and assembly are performed on the first stage, the S1C. This facility is located about 15 miles east of New Orleans and occupies some 900 acres in that area. Now, only about 35 miles away is the Mississippi Test Facility, located in Hancock County, Mississippi. The test facility is provided with navigable channels from the Pearl River, which allows water transportation from the Michoud Assembly Plant to the test facility, even to the test stand itself. And that's where we do the static testing of that particular stage. Now, you asked about logistics. The transportation provided from the contractor and NASA plants is facilitated by a fleet of 9 ships and barges and 2 modified aircraft, which help us move these huge stages around the United States, eventually down to the launch facility. Last year, for example, the Saturn V transportation mileage alone exceeded 224,000.
Thank you, General O'Connor. This is Randy Neely talking with Brigadier General Edmund O'Connor, Director of Industrial Operations at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama.
Apollo 4 interview number 6 with Tim Creedon.
This is Glenn Broman at Kennedy Space Center, Florida. Tim Creedon is test support controller at Launch Complex 39. Tim, what about the major launch facilities, launch-connected facilities like the VAB and the MSS? What are those things? What do they stand for?
The VAB, as we affectionately call it, the barn, is one of the largest buildings in the world. This building is used for the erection and the assembly of the space vehicle on the mobile launcher. Various testing is done in this building, and when it's ready to roll out to the pad, the crawler transporter enters the VAB and picks up the mobile launcher, the space vehicle, and proceeds down the crawlerway to the pad. The pad is located some 3.5 miles from the VAB. The crawler travels at about a tenth of a mile an hour making this trip. It averages a total of something like 6 hours on trips to the pad. Once the vehicle is out at the pad, it's secured on its supports, and the crawler leaves it at that point and proceeds to bring up the mobile service structure, which you mentioned previously. This is a large structure, larger than the vehicle itself, and it is used to gain access to the various vehicle compartments and allow further testing and work to ensue.
Now, also here at the launch complex, there are a total of, 3 mobile launchers, there are 2 transporters, there's facilities for high-pressure gas and pumping stations and fuel storage.
This is right. This is the converter-compressor facility, which is actually a plant in itself. From this storage area, various gases, exotic gases like hydrogen, oxygen, helium, so forth, are pumped and compressed and sent overland through lines to the various areas of the space vehicle itself. There are also storage areas surrounding the pad perimeter, which contain fuels. In close to the pad itself, there's cryogenic complexes where the very exotic fuels are pumped on board.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Tim Creedon, test support controller here at the complex. This is Glenn Broman at Kennedy Space Center.
Apollo 4 interview number 7 with Charles Henschel.
This is Glenn Broman at Kennedy Space Center, Florida. We're in firing room 1 of the Launch Control Center, talking with Charles Henschel, space vehicle test supervisor for the Apollo 4 mission.
Apollo 4 interview number 8 on the crawler transporter operation.
This is Glenn Broman at Kennedy Space Center, Florida.
Apollo 4 interview number 9 with Ed Lawless.
This is Jim Kukowski at the NASA Communications Center at Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. We're located in the NASCOM Communications Center, the heart of the worldwide communication center for NASA. Speaking to Ed Lawless, who is the voice supervisor of NASCOM. Ed, could you tell us about this long switchboard with the flashing lights? What is the purpose of it, and how will it help the communications procedures here for NASA during the Apollo flights?
Right. The purpose of the switchboard is to provide us with a versatile, flexible means of interconnecting and switching voice-grade circuitry. We're able to terminate here 220 circuits with unlimited conferencing capability. An example of the type of conferencing we would be doing here during Apollo would be the flight director's circuit referred to as GOSS-1 or Goddard Conference. This is the circuit that allows the flight director and personnel at Houston to talk direct to the astronauts in flight.
Now, you mentioned that we will have 220 circuits for the Apollo flight. How many stations are there? Where are they located generally? And how many countries are involved?
Well, approximately 30 countries of the free world. Circuitry-wise, going to the east, we work through switching centers in London and Madrid. We have tracking sites located in the Canary Islands, Madrid, Spain. Tananarive. I could keep going on. It'll get quite extensive if I list them all.
How many people would be actually involved during an Apollo flight in the voice communications network?
Hey, well, if you'll notice, we have three consoles here. They duplicate one another. This means we have three controller positions. This allows any one of three controllers to operate independent of the others so we can handle our other day-to-day support. Not only do we support Apollo from here, but we also support the JPL missions from Pasadena, such as the deep space probes. In fact, today we're busy with Surveyor support, which just landed on the moon. Also, the Goddard support of the Stadan network and the Earth Orbit Scientific satellites. So we have three controllers on duty at the consoles at all times. Now, concerning themselves with Apollo will be one controller and usually two supervisory personnel in the background to handle patching, coordination, and logging.
Now, putting it to the average citizen, if you or I want to make a transatlantic telephone call, sometimes it can take anywhere from 15 to minutes to possibly 2 hours. What about the speed of this voice communications network, where speed is so important in manned flight?
Well, you just have to say it's instantaneous. All of our circuitry is full-time. It's dedicated to NASA and NASA endeavors. You must always bear in mind, especially in support of a mission like Apollo or a manned space flight, that this system in itself functions as a life support system.
Would it be possible at this moment to give us a demonstration here of the communications capabilities on the voice network?
Certainly, be happy to. I think what I'll do is show you the conferencing capability, conference some of these centers, give them a quick voice call, see how they hear me, and it shouldn't take us very long at all. As you can see, the system is fully operated via push buttons, so we'll just press on. It shouldn't take us any time.
All right, will you describe who we're talking to? And, of course, we can probably hear them over the speakers here.
Right. What I'll do right now, I'll depress this button here. I'll seize a circuit to London, a circuit to Madrid, a circuit to Honolulu, and a circuit to Canberra, Australia. We have that set right now. We'll go ahead and see if they're copying. London, Goddard Voice, Ottawa.
Goddard Voice, London.
Roger, how do you hear me?
I read you loud and clear, Goddard, help me.
Roger, same. Thank you very much.
Roger, London.
Madrid, Goddard Voice.
This is Madrid, NASCOM. Go ahead.
Roger, Madrid, Goddard, I read you loud and clear, how me?
I read you also loud and clear.
Roger, thank you.
Thank you, Madrid, I've been out.
Goddard out. Honolulu, Goddard voice, how copy?
Honolulu copy is loud and clear, how me?
Roger, you're loud and clear, thank you, Honolulu.
Roger, Honolulu.
Canberra, Australia, Goddard voice, how copy?
I read you loud and clear, Goddard, how me?
Roger, loud and clear. Also, while I have you here, Canberra, how's the weather there?
Weather's fine. Just coming on spring.
Roger, it's just going into fall here. I guess it's our turn to be envious of your weather.
Yes, we might stop you, sir.
Roger. Thank you very much, Canberra. Got it out. So that is an example of how we can readily configure circuits. As you noticed, they answered up immediately. They do function as a extension of our switching center here. They are an integral part of the NASCOM network. From their centers, we take our circuitry into certain selected tracking sites.
Ed Lawless, who is the voice supervisor of Communication Center for NASA. This is Jim Kukowski at Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland.
Apollo 4 interview number 10 with Mike Stevens.
This is Jim Kukowski. We're now located in the Worldwide Manned Spaceflight Network Operations Control Center. I'm speaking to Mike Stevens, the Network Operations Manager. Mike, basically, what is the purpose of the Manned Spaceflight Network Operations Control Center?
Well, the control center is the hub of all the manned spaceflight network stations that support the Apollo missions. We have here all the communications, data, teletype that come from Houston and go out to the sites, or come from the sites, the worldwide network, and go back into Houston. We have here the direction to the network in the support of a manned spaceflight mission as far as preparing that network to support a mission.
Now, you're an old hand here at Goddard Space Flight Center. I imagine things have changed quite drastically since the earlier days of manned spaceflight, particularly with Mercury. How has it changed since Mercury, now that we're approaching the Apollo flights?
Well, I think the biggest change, of course, is the systems that supported the Mercury program throughout the world. As far on the sites, they have become more complex. The approach we take to those systems as far as getting them ready to support a mission takes more people, more time. The systems themselves have grown to an extent of twice the size or complexity that we had in Mercury. The role of the network support team that operates from this control center has grown considerably. We started with two or three systems advisors, and now it takes approximately 20 systems advisors to do the job.
Now, this is the control center. Could you give us an example of the types of information which will be sent from one of our tracking sites? Shall we take Tananarive? How will this information be sent to this center? What will happen in this center, and where will it go from here?
Well, Tananarive itself is primarily a tracking and telemetry receive and record and a air-to-ground site. The tracking data, radar tracking data, will come to us via teletype low-speed lines, go into the computers here at Goddard and also to the computers at Houston. The computers here will then feed the data to the network support team, who uses this data and displays to evaluate the performance of the Tananarive radar, and plus gives us an indication of how the mission is going. And Houston uses the data as orbit determination. The telemetry data comes from the spacecraft and it is received at Tananarive and is recorded at Tananarive for local evaluation and for further evaluation by data people after the mission is over with. And of course, the air-to-ground system is used for communicating from the Houston Control Center through the Tananarive station to the spacecraft and back.
All right, thank you very much, Mike Stevens, Network Operations Manager of the Worldwide Manned Spaceflight Network Operations Control Center at Goddard Space Flight Center. This is Jim Kukowski.